This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
How are you feeling today on the What Differences Make podcast?
I am feeling fabuloso today. How are you feeling?
Okay. I'm just trying to think of some 80s photograph, you know, Def Leppard photograph or centerfold. But there's a lot of 80s songs that talk about photographs. Photos used to be important, Holly.
Girls on film?
Girls on film. Yeah. He filmed some girls on film. He got some boys on film. Who are we talking about who got these boys and girls on film?
Today, our guest is Steve Repport. He is a fabulous rock photographer. He has photographed all of our favorite bands from the 80s, and he has stories about each and every one of them, as I learned from his website, mostlyrockandroll.com, and cannot wait to ask him stories about some of our favorites.
He lived during a time where it was kind of exciting, where you can take a photograph and send it to a magazine, and the magazine would respond and say, hey, we like your work. We got a good summer job for you. How about filming The Clash for us?
Yeah, imagine that back in the day.
Yeah. So we're going to get into a lot of his stories. And before we do that, Holly, how do we tell our stories?
We tell our stories on our social media, on the What Difference Does It Make YouTube channel, and on our social media at WDDIM podcast. You will see outtakes from this interview with Steve and also some of his beautiful artwork we're going to showcase.
This is Steve Repport on the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Hi.
Hello there.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Where are you in right now? What city?
Probably New Orleans.
Probably.
Or New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. Orleans. Right. You got to learn how to pronounce this.
I hear people from here go, New Orleans. Even though most people say, you know, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. I mean, I hear it every which way. And that's not even tourists. That's from like Louisianans. So
just say Nolins. N-A-W-L-I-N-S.
I can't say that because I feel like I'm betraying myself if I say that.
I wonder if that's a thing. Like I have heard that, and I've seen it written that way from in books that are set in New Orleans. But I wonder if that's a thing, like San Francisco, like people who refer to San Francisco as Frisco, which you don't really do.
No, you do not do. No.
Oh, you know, you live there.
Yeah, I just moved from there. 30 years.
Well, we're from Los Angeles, so we really don't care about San Francisco.
Anyway, moving on. So yesterday, can I just tell you what happened yesterday? So I was in the gallery yesterday, and my friend Ben Jaffe is kind of the main reason I moved here. But Ben texts me and says, where are you? I said, I'm at the gallery. He said, well, Amy Schumer's here, so I want to bring her over. I said, oh, okay, that'd be great. So Amy Schumer comes into the gallery, and then she looks around and she says, yeah, I definitely want to buy some stuff. I'll bring my husband in here. You know, we're moving here. They bought a house in New Orleans. And then she says, do you want to shoot my show? She's playing at the Sanger last night. So I'm like, yes. And then Ben is a part owner of the Toulouse Theatre, so she's also doing an after show at the Toulouse. So I end up taking pictures of Amy at the Sanger, being on stage with her at the end to get that shot of her walking off stage. Did some pictures in the dressing room beforehand, and got some pictures of her at the Toulouse. And I just can't believe that my life has turned out like this. I looked her up on Instagram afterwards to see, you know, just to follow her. And I thought, oh, she's got 12,000 followers. That's the same as me. And then I reread it and it said 12.1 million.
Yeah, yeah.
that's a small country.
I love her. I can see how that would be a thrill of a lifetime. And I would be pinching myself.
You know, I just posted literally at 11:59. I was just about to go into this Zoom and I just finished posting an Instagram post saying, you know, in New Orleans, you have to expect the unexpected for that moment that Amy Schumer comes into your gallery and then says, do you want to shoot my show tonight? And suddenly, you know, your day completely changes, your night completely changes.
I'm busy tonight. Sorry, I wish I could.
I was thinking of saying that. I was actually going to go to this jazz thing that I go to on a Thursday night, but I managed not to say that out loud.
Okay, so when you went to the show, obviously you're focused on what you're doing, but were you able to listen to her at all, or did you? Yeah,
when I was shooting the actual show, it was a bit hard to shoot while you're laughing because you got to keep the camera still, and I'm trying to be unobtrusive as well. So that's a pretty funny experience.
Did you give her access to the photos, or what happens during shows like this? Like when it's just kind of an impromptu thing, do you send her all the photos, or are these your property now?
That's a good question, because we just left it at that. Amy said, do you want to come and shoot the show? I said, yes. And then her assistant, Elsie, she said, let me put you in touch with this person who's going to pay you. I'm like, oh, we didn't discuss payment or anything. She just said, do you want to shoot the pictures? And I said, yes. And I got fairly unprecedented for me access, quick shots in the dressing room. I got feedback today that she thought it was the nicest portrait she's ever had taken of her. That was from my friend Ben, who's good friends with Amy. He's the one who introduced us. So, I'm a bit speechless about the whole thing, really.
Yeah, going to go on the road with Amy. Nice.
Yeah, I guess being speechless on a podcast is not the way to go. So
that's payment enough, right? That's the best portrait of me ever.
I don't think that pays the rent.
I don't know. Yeah, we haven't. It's funny that we just haven't discussed. It's very loose. And that's my life right now. It's just, I just shoot. I just like shooting. And I'm old. So, I don't really need, I'm not hustling for money. It's nice. It's really liberating.
Okay, you're leading into it. So what we read, you were photographing these artists, and then you dropped out of photography and you became a Taekwondo martial arts instructor, but without explaining how you get there.
You know, there's that Monty Python sketch where a guy is a chartered accountant and he wants to be a lion tamer, and he's going to career advice and says, I want to be a lion tamer. I want to be out there taming lions. And he says, do you not think you should take it in steps and maybe via banking, let's say banking? So I didn't really do it via banking. I just went from, actually I went from photographer to web developer to managing web developers and then teaching martial arts in the evenings. And then when I got laid off from my second .com job, or got laid off for the second time from a .com job, I bought the school that I'd been teaching Taekwondo and kickboxing at. And I did that for 20 years. And then I was known as this, I had these pictures for several years. I had these pictures in the stairwell at my gym of, David Bowie and Prince. And no one really knew exactly what to make of it. Like, oh, I guess he likes music. And I play music, during the classes. But I'm not sure too many people put together for a long time that, that was my career. Some people did. I was saying this morning, I went to an exercise class this morning at my local gym. And we were talking about David Bowie. And I said, there was a kickboxing class. We had these stretching bars in the upstairs gym. We were doing our warm-ups. And then I told the class, go and stand by the wall. As I said that, David Bowie was singing, standing by the wall. And I said, did you hear that? That's amazing. And in New Orleans, that happens pretty much at least once a day.
Ghosts or what? Or just unexplained occurrences?
So yesterday, I was in the gallery yesterday, and this bloke comes in, and I was playing Songs to Sing and Learn by Echo and the Bunnymen, one of my favorite bands. This bloke comes in and he's looking through some note cards, and I look over and he's singing the words. Oh, you're singing along with Echo and the Bunnymen. That's amazing. And then he pulls up his sleeve and he's got lyrics from The Promise tattooed on his arm. And I just literally, 5 minutes before the first track on the album is The Promise. And he didn't hear the music and come in. He was walking down St. Peter Street. He saw the gallery, came in. He's looking through, and I have an Echo and the Bunnymen book, and he's got a Bunnymen tattoo. I mean, I don't know what the odds are. It's not London. It's not, Liverpool. It's New Orleans, and he's a Bunnymen fan. So we had a lot of bunny conversations, and it was very bunny. But that sort of thing, I say it's magic. I say there's just magic in the streets in New Orleans. It's incredible. The story of how I came to, how I met Ben and how I came to move to New Orleans, and how it was a confluence. It's Ben Jaffe and Joe Strummer that got me, and The Clash that got me to New Orleans. Last December, I got a phone call. And this was weird because it was someone who found me on Instagram, found my phone number on Instagram and called me to order a print. Which that's the only time that's ever happened, I think. And he said, hi, my name's Ben. I was interested in one of your limited edition, very limited edition, 16x20 contact sheet prints. That's a print of a scanned contact sheet of the Clash gig from the Lyceum in 1981. October the 18th, 1981. They did 7 nights at the Lyceum. This was the first night. So he said, my name's Ben. And then it turns out he lives in New Orleans. So I'm like, oh, that's great. I said, I'm actually coming out in March. I bought tickets ages ago to see Pogatry. So Pogatry, or Pogatry in Motion, is Spider Stacy and Kurt O'Rourdan, otherwise known as Rocky O'Rourdan, who were in the Pogues, loved the Pogues, took pictures of them back in the 80s. Spider and Louise Stacy live in New Orleans. And Louise, we were in touch because she entered one of my competitions for a giveaway of a Paul Weller print. She didn't win it. So we were in contact. So I thought, oh, Pogatry is playing in New Orleans at Tipitina's. And it was, you know, coming out of COVID. I thought, that's going to be my first trip. I haven't been to New Orleans since 1984 when I worked on Spandau Ballet's I'll Fly For You video. So I told Ben, I'm coming out to see Pogatry. And it's actually Pogatry, it's Spider and Cop with Los Bay Ramblers, who are a local, I think they're actually from Lafayette. They're like a Cajun band, Acadian / Cajun band. He said, oh, well, then he starts telling me about his band. I'm in a band myself. Oh, what band are you in? So it's called Preservation Hall Jazz Band. I said, that sounds great. He said, well, would you like to take pictures of the band? So while we're talking, I'm looking up Preservation Hall Jazz Band and my eyes are getting really big. Well, that sounds amazing. So I was just getting back into rock and roll photography, trying to, you know, make my way back in after 25, 27 years away from it. So I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. So we arranged that we'd meet when I got down there. And then I finished the story on the phone call. He said, I want to buy this picture of The Clash. I'd also like to buy a print of David Bowie for my friends Wynn and Regine. So again, my eyes went like this. Wynn and Regine are your friends. I said, I love Arcade Fire. I've loved Arcade Fire since the first album. I said, yeah, they live here. I said, I didn't know they lived in New Orleans. I thought they were in Canada. I said, no, they've been here for a few years. I said, wonderful. So, well, he finished the conversation because after about an hour, Ben said, I'm sorry, I have to go. And he just hung up. And things like that happen. And they're like, I didn't close the sale. He didn't buy the print. That was really weird. It was a great conversation. You know, when you meet someone and you just like connect immediately, and we just chatted for ages about music. So I didn't hear from him for 2 days. And then he called me back. And in the meantime, I look up Preservation Hall, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, Arcade Fire, Wynn and Regine. And it turns out that Arcade Fire and Ben Jaffe went to Haiti. They did this whole fundraising thing. You know, Arcade Fire have a lot to do with Haiti. Paul Bobrun is in the band. He's from Haiti. Like, all these connections. And then I read about Alan Jaffe, his father, who, you know, was a preservation musician. He and his wife came to New Orleans in 1961 from New York on a road trip, and then they fell in love with it and stayed and ended up owning and running Preservation Hall. And Ben was basically born there, grew up there, and became a Preservation Hall musician. 2 days later, he calls me back and he said, I'm so sorry I had to hang up on you. While we were talking on the phone, my mother passed away.
Oh, my God.
I know, right? I mean, I lost my mom, you know, 14 years ago. I didn't even know what to say. She was sick. It was kind of expected. But still, it was literally in the middle of our conversation. So you know how you know that kind of somehow bonded us. It was a very, like, kind of reaction and feeling. So anyway, you know, he bought the prints. He arranged for me to shoot the band. And then when I got here, met the band. And I can't explain the feeling being at Preservation Hall and then going to the back to the courtyard. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's a really, really special place for someone who loves music and loves jazz. I can honestly say, you know, I never had anyone's phone number in my life. No one ever gave me their phone number. Maybe my friend Nasha, who was in Frankie Goes to Hollywood, he gave me his phone number. Everyone gives you their number and you follow them on Instagram and they follow you back and you message each other and I send them pictures. And I just never experienced anything like it. So by the end of that week, Ben introduced Arcade Fire to me, and then I ended up, they hired me to shoot their shows at the Toulouse Theatre. They hadn't played for 2 years. That was an incredible experience. End up on the stage, at the back of the stage with Arcade Fire, shooting that picture where they turn around. And I thought that was exceptional. I didn't realize that that's what everyone does these days, because I've been out of the, you know, that so long. I thought this was the most amazing thing ever. Wynn looks over to me and says, he says to the crowd, let's get a picture. And he looks over at me and like, me? You want me to go on the drum riser and take a picture? Yeah, apparently that's what they do now. Yeah, by the end of that week, I ended up staying longer. I was supposed to be there for 4 days. I extended my trip so that I could hang out with Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They had a bunch of events over the weekend, keep shooting them. And then Arcade Fire shows were Sunday and Monday, and they hired me to do that. And by Tuesday, when I went home, I decided to move here. Called my realtor. She came over on the Thursday, put the house on the market on the Sunday, sold the house on the Thursday, came back about 2 weeks later, met a realtor on the Thursday morning to go and look at places. found this place, made an offer on the Friday, had it accepted on the Sunday, and came back again for the second weekend of Jazz Fest and stayed in my new house, sleeping on the floor, and then moved here at the end of May.
We are talking with mostly rock and roll photographer Steve Rapport, but we need to take five. Actually, not even five. Less than that. We will be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And we're back on the What Difference Does It Make podcast with photographer Steve Rapport. How does one get into rock and roll photography? How does then back to the story about leaving photography and getting into martial art, teaching martial arts, and then getting back into it? How does that, that's...
And tell it in 30 seconds or less, please.
In the middle of 1981, Robert Plant came to my university, which was University of Warwick in Coventry, with the Honey Drippers. It was a charity for a concert for International Year of the Disabled. I took pictures. They were not very good pictures. The lighting was terrible. But like in a Bruce Springsteen song, I literally got a bus from Coventry, a bus or a coach, to Victoria, a bus station. And no phones or anything then, right? So I actually went to a phone booth, a phone box, and opened the Yellow Pages and looked for music papers. Now, NME was the music paper that I read, New Musical Express. I thought, who would be interested in Robert Plant pictures? Not New NME, Sounds. Called them. They said, come over to Covent Garden. I went over to Covent Garden. Eric Fuller, the picture editor, looked at my little portfolio, looked at the picture of Robert Plant, said, yes, we can use this. Can you write 50 words for a little caption for it, for the kind of news section? Okay, I did that. And said, well, if anything's happening in Coventry, which is where I was at university, in my third year of a PhD in law and public order, imagine Coventry, the Specials, the punk scene, the Clash, the Jam, I don't know, the Members, Wire, the Damned, you know, all these Stranglers, all these punk bands playing everywhere, Blondie, going to see a ton of bands all the time with all my friends, come to my office and we just listen to music. I didn't have any classes, I was supposed to write this thesis that I was not really getting very far on. They said, well, if anything is happening in Coventry, we'll get in touch with you. I don't know how they got in touch with me, because a raven, maybe they sent a raven, because how did you get in touch with someone in 1981? The Specials are playing at Butts Stadium. I kid you not, Butts Stadium in Coventry. Do you want to take pictures? Yes. Took pictures of the Specials, took a box of pictures back to London to the magazine, to Sounds, and they said, well, look, if you were to come back to London, we could probably give you a lot of work. This is the middle of 81. And it was the end of the school year. I was nowhere near finishing my thesis. I was from London. So I moved back and boom, 5 or 6 nights a week at gigs, sometimes 2 gigs a night. And imagine, 81. So yeah. I know that I sort of clashed, and then the Ramones 4 days later. That same year, Stray Cats, Elvis Costello, the Go-Go's twice, I think. Just incredible. And then started doing pictures for features as well, and then for magazines, newspapers, record companies, and it just kind of took off from there. And then you're in it, so you don't really think about it. You know, that career lasted till 92, and it kind of tailed off, because the early 80s was such an amazing time. 81 through 85, 86 for me was just, you know, the Style Council, Echo and the Bunnymen, just these fantastic bands that I loved. I went on the road with Red Wedge, which was a left-wing political group that Billy Bragg and Paul Weller organized. So I got to ride a bus with you know, the Style Council and Billy Bragg and the Communards and Johnny Marr and Lloyd Cole was there, and some of Madness came along, and Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet. It was incredible. And then I started working on, I got hired to shoot a lot of stills on videos. So starting with ABC's Poison Arrow, which is directed by Julian Temple, that was kind of a mind-blowing experience. It was very visual because it was Julian Temple. And I did a really good job on that. That was just for a magazine. And then record companies started hiring me. So a lot of Tim Pope videos, The Creatures, The Style Council, Soft Cell, Pretenders, The Cure. And then I worked on 7 Eurythmics videos. And I was the only one who was really doing that as a really important part of their career. So I worked on maybe 200 videos that you were over here would have seen on MTV. American photographers covering videos would just do like behind the scenes with the camera crew. And I thought they were horrible pictures and they used flash. And I thought it was like my job was to be like a Hollywood film photographer, you know, movie set photographer doing Hollywood portraits. So I try and use the lighting and the set and the makeup and the clothing and everything to make great portraits. That was kind of my goal doing that. It was a really fun time, and then much less fun. And I'd already decided to move to the States. And when I moved here to the Bay Area, just the music just wasn't as interesting to me anymore. And it was getting harder and harder and harder to work with bands.
What year was this?
Moved in 92.
Oh, so but that was like during the grunge era. So that's kind of, yeah, it's kind of a interesting time.
It was, but you know, I was in San Francisco and I didn't get to shoot any of the grunge bands. I went to see Pearl Jam. I saw a lot of Neil Young's shows at the Bridge School benefits. So I was really into all those bands. And he had Tom Waits there, and he had Tom Petty there and Bruce Springsteen. But that was as a punter. I wasn't photographing. So I did a bunch of stuff when I moved here for Vox magazine in England, because I couldn't work for Americans, only English. I could only work for non-American based organizations because of my visa, you know, because I didn't have a green card yet. So this one magazine, they sent me to LA a bunch to shoot Ice-T twice, Coolio, REM. I did the Lemonheads, Evan Dando and the Lemonheads, and Juliana Hatfield, PJ Harvey. Came down to LA to do Mazzy Star. And most of those pictures are gone. Most of those pictures I don't have, or I have hardly any of them. I have no idea why. And The Verve. I spent 3 days with The Verve in Hollywood, which was a brilliant experience. But the magazine, the picture editor didn't like the pictures very much. So I said, okay, if you don't like those pictures, then fuck it. You know, I don't think there's any point us working together anymore. And that kind of was the final nail in the coffin. Oh, and Prince in San Francisco, but we didn't get to meet him. So, that was the story. It was just, you know, you used to be able to shoot a whole show, and then suddenly it became 4 numbers only, and then 3 numbers only, and then sometimes it was 2, and occasionally it was 1. I thought, this is really unprofessional. You can't ask someone to do their job like this. Photographers were really disrespected because of the paparazzi at that point. They gave us all a really bad name. I wasn't as much into the music, although, like you said, there was grunge, and I loved Counting Crows when I moved to San Francisco. The final nail in the coffin was REM. They were playing at the Shoreline Amphitheater, which is about a 50-mile drive or 40-mile drive from San Francisco. But Thursday night, you know, it's 2 hours in the car. And we got one number. And this was for Vox. It was for a big feature. They sent a journalist over from England, I think. And it was one number. And then after the one number, the security walked us all out of the Shoreline. And I'm just standing outside there with my camera bag, like, what just happened? I want to see REM. I don't have a ticket. That had never happened in my life before. So I got back in the car, drove all the way back to San Francisco. So I did like a 4 or 5 hour trip for one number. And then this weird thing happened in the car on the way back. K-Fog was all the way back, was playing It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. They played it over and over and over again for the whole journey back. Okay, so this segues into another story, which is capped by last night, because last night, after Amy Schumer at the Sanger and then at the Toulouse Theatre is owned by a bunch of musicians now, and Wynn Butler was there, so I hung out a little bit with Wynn. Well, Wynn's part of the story, because that trip here to New Orleans in March, when I was shooting Arcade Fire and I was at the Preservation Hall, Ben from Preservation Hall texted me and said, I'm going over to Arcade Fire's rehearsal, just one block away at the Toulouse. I said, oh, will I be able to come over? He said, let me go over there and find out. So he goes over there and he texts me and he says, well, they're just finishing the rehearsal, but why don't you come over? So I went over and I'm standing at the back. It's like 10 people there in this theater. And then they finish their soundtrack and they just start playing again. And they play, guess what they play all the way through? End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. And anyway, so we might as well just, you know, fuck it, just do what you want
to. Sell your house and move to New Orleans.
Move to New Orleans, yeah.
You might as well.
I understand much better. I get the transition a little bit better because it seems like going from something so, you know, big and meaningful to you. Well, obviously, Taekwondo must mean something to you too if you devote your life to that for a while.
30-second version. So as soon as I moved here, I started doing Taekwondo, and I'd been doing jiu-jitsu in England, Japanese jiu-jitsu. In 95, I got my black belt, and then immediately my master had me teaching. So I was teaching 3 classes a week and then started doing kickboxing as well. But this was while I was doing web design and development. And then in 92, like I said, I got laid off. I ended up buying the gym from my grandmaster, had that gym for 20 odd years through COVID, lost the gym, got sued by the landlord for all the back rent. And in that intervening period, my archive, my photo archive, was in a garage in Oxfordshire from 1992 until 2017. So my friend finally boxed everything up and shipped it to me. It was in filing cabinets. And while he was trying to get these filing cabinets open, there was no keys for them and they were locked. One of them fell on his head and had a huge gash on his head and blood everywhere. He sent me pictures of it. So that was the legacy of my archive. Tons is missing, but he did send me, you know, 6 filing cabinets full of, or 4 filing cabinets worth of material. And then I started scanning it. And this is literally only, what is it now, coming up for 5 years ago. But here's the interesting thing. You don't go back through your archive. Maybe if you have a retrospective, if you're doing a book. And a lot of my contemporaries, they kept doing photography that whole time. But I think it's true for them as well. Now we're all older and started going back through our archives. You're like, holy shit. You know, you go and see a band and we'll say The Clash. You go through you process your film, you make your contact sheets, you look through them with an eyeglass, you mark up the best ones and you print maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. And then, you know, you take those to the magazine or the paper and then you've got your next job. And then time goes by and you never go back to it. And I started going through these negatives and these contact sheets thinking, holy shit, I had no idea I'd taken this picture of Freddie Mercury in black and white where he's like, Mama, you know, or the picture of Joe Strummer with his arm out, which is on the wall. If you can quite see it, it's on the wall behind me. I think it's right there. Yeah, these incredible pictures that I didn't know I'd taken because you never spent the time looking through your material, through your back catalogue or your archive. A bit like maybe, let's say, Bruce Springsteen going through his tapes every now and then and thinking, shit, I wrote this song in like 1976. Never recorded it. This is a great song.
You're discovering new things, finding little details. Like with Paul Weller, you see on the side of his boombox, there's a little quote.
Ring, ring, 7 a.m. from Magnificent Seven by The Clash. Oh, that made my day. That made my year, actually. Finding that link between The Clash and the Jam, or The Clash and Paul Weller. There is a photo of Joe Strummer and Paul Weller that I absolutely love, the two of them together. It's like a nexus. That's one I wish I'd taken.
All right, so I always ask, the Tears for Fears quote is, kick out the style, bring back the jam. Who were you? Were you team jam or team style?
Both. These days, I listen to the Style Council a lot more than I listen to the Jam. I think they were way ahead of their time. But I love the Jam. I used to go and see them a ton. I used to see the Jam and the Clash a ton, every opportunity. 77, 78, 79, 80, 81. Before I was a photographer, when I would smuggle my camera in as a student and when I was a professional as well. I'm very kind of fortunate in that regard. But I really did love the Style Council. I love Paul Weller and I still do. Love Joe Strummer and I still do. You know, when I go back through the archives, it's a privilege to have been at all those events. Even Style Council were at Live Aid, but I think most people forget that. They were either the first band or one of the first bands on a Live Aid.
Okay, so I had a couple questions. First of all, well, I was going to ask you about The Long Hot Summer. I just rewatched that video and like, oh my God, this is really, it's hot. Mm-hmm. Tell your Long Hot Summer story and your role in that video.
No, sure. I really had a role other than, you know, I'm taking pictures, smiling all day. It was a gorgeous day, number one. It was on the river in Cambridge. It was on the Cam. It was filmed at Grantchester Meadow, which, if you're an old Pink Floyd fan, that was a Pink Floyd, a very early Pink Floyd song called Grantchester Meadow, because I think Syd Barrett, I think, used to live there. And I think David Gilmour or Roger lives near there now as well. And that's a recent thing that I found out, that connection between that and Pink Floyd, which kind of that blew my mind as well. So it was just an incredible day. It's a Tim Pope video. So Tim's really wacky. He's a wacky genius of pop videos and movies. And Paul is just really playful. Paul likes kind of fucking with people and tearing up his image and subverting his image. And he was just, you know, he's got his shirt off. It's like a picnic. It's the summer. It's a beautiful day. They're by the river. They're on boats. And Paul and Mick are just like stroking each other's head and everyone's laughing. And it became this whole thing. It became this whole, oh, is Paul gay? I don't think Paul cares whether he's gay or not. You know, he's just stroking Mick's head while not wearing a shirt. While lying.
A lot of undertones there. Yeah, I did. Of course, I didn't realize it at the time when I was a kid. But now watching it, like, oh, my God, am I really in love with Paul Weller? Like,
I think we're all in love with Paul Weller. I mean, the pictures I have of him from that video, they're hot. Let's be honest, he's got his shirt off. He looks like some kind of god in a lot of the pictures. The smoking doesn't turn me on, but he looks cool when he's smoking as well. And it's just Paul, you know. It's funny because I have the most amazing pictures, I think, of Paul Weller. And I spent a ton of time with him, but I didn't feel like I ever really got to know him. Not like, say, Billy Bragg. But I think it's just Paul. I think Paul's pretty shy and he has a lot of opinions, a lot of great opinions, actually. But I never felt like we were necessarily mates, even though, you know, I worked with him a lot. And I kind of wish I'd worked with him more over the years, over the later years. But I got to take pictures of him again in May, back in England. I didn't get to meet him this time, but that was pretty special.
This year, we've been following the year 1985. That seems to be a good year for you. But it's also the year of Live Aid. So tell me, were you in London? Were you in Philly? Or where were you? What?
So this is 1981. This is the start of my career. This is 1992. 81, 82, 83, 84, 85. Whoa! Oh, 86, 87, 88, 89. Until it's gone off screen. I was kind of on top of the world in 85. You know, I did that great shot of Annie Lennox at the Churchill Hotel, David Bowie's Loving the Alien, Single Sleeve. When I look back at the 85 stuff, Tina Turner, I think, was in 85 in the studio, Live Aid. So I was hired by Smash Hits. I worked a lot for Smash Hits, and they asked me to do the cover story, the Live Aid cover feature. You don't know at the time that it's going to turn out to be, you know, the biggest show in history. It was watched by 1.9 billion people. And bear in mind, there were only 4 or 5 billion people on the planet back then as well. So it was something like 40% of the world's population tuned in. So I was in London. I was at Wembley Stadium, completely unaware, really, I think, of what's going on in Philly, other than I think it was probably on the big screen. If they had a big screen back, maybe they didn't even have a big screen back then. I don't remember. I think they'd have gaps because there'd be music going on in Philly and then it would cut back to Wembley. I never saw the whole of the American version of Live Aid.
It was good. It's worth seeing.
You know, there's that scene in Bohemian Rhapsody at Wembley where the camera zooms over Wembley towards the stage and you see the photo pit there. There's people there as me. I mean, I could argue that someone played me in that movie. I mean, it was special, wasn't it? Most of my Live Aid pictures, like most of the Live Aid photographers, have gone. They're literally gone. My understanding is that the Band Aid Trust eventually just threw them all away.
Wow. You didn't have possession of these photos, or you gave them all to Live Aid?
So what would happen with Live Aid? None of us got paid. We all donated our fees to Live Aid / Band Aid, the Band Aid Trust. And then I think we all agreed that once our papers or magazines had done their features, we would send all the best stuff over to Live Aid, which we did. They used a lot of my pictures in the book. If anyone has the Live Aid book out there or the Live Aid calendar, I actually have both at the gallery. They used quite a few of my pictures, but we never got our pictures back from them. And then over the years, I wondered what happened to it. And one of my friends, I think it was Andrew Catlin or Tom Sheehan, went to the Band Aid Trust and they had these big garbage bags full of transparencies. And he said they weren't even in their mounts. I mean, there's no way to identify someone's photograph if it's a color transparency except by the mount, because we'd have our own stamp and phone number and address and whatever on the mount. Once you take that transparency, which is basically just a positive negative, positive version of a negative, which is a stupid thing to say. But anyway, you take it out of the mount and it could be anyone's. I mean, we're all basically in the same spot taking the same pictures. And they were just in these trash bags, and then apparently they threw them all away. Those trash bags were just tossed. And even if they weren't, no one would have known whose picture was whose anymore. So I'm lucky that I have a few fairly nice pictures from Live Aid, but I have one frame of Freddie performing on his own. I have none of Bowie. I have one of Bono, one of Brian Ferry, two of Adam Ant, a lot of other bands. I have virtually nothing. Or I have just like crap, you know, not the good stuff. George Michael, two frames of Elton John, two decent frames of Paul McCartney. But I do seem to have the images that we use in Smash Hits by and large. And I'm not even sure if they're originals. There's no way to tell with color whether they're originals or dupes. No way that I know, because the agency that I syndicated through would make duplicate transparencies. But it's the same film. It doesn't say D on it for duplicate. I suspect that all the Live Aid pictures that I have are not originals, but I'm not 100% sure. The actual transparencies that I make my prints from, they don't really look like originals. They don't look crisp like an original film, but I don't know.
I mean, I distinctly remember Bono climbing into the photographer's well. How close were you during that moment?
I was right there. Same with Freddie. Although, analyzing it a little bit, I think for Freddie, I might have been in the pit on the right and not the one in the middle. Because I have that picture, I don't know if you saw it, with the guitar over his head, and there's the starburst from the head of the guitar. And I watched that on the movie, and it looks like I wasn't where the camera was in the middle. I was, over the side, and that's why I was able to get that picture. So maybe we moved between the different photographers' areas, or maybe we were cycled through. I really don't remember. I know I was right in the middle for the finale. I was right by the piano. So I definitely wasn't over on the right for the whole show. I don't ever remember being over there. But when I looked at the Bono coming down into the crowd, I think maybe I was over there because I have a picture of him from the side. That's the only image I have of him on his own performing. You know, it's great that I have what I have, and it's just sad that I don't have like the pick of the bunch. But I am grateful to have any, you know, nice pics. And I found found my Live Aid ticket. I have it on display at the gallery. I didn't even know we had tickets. You know, I thought we just had passes. Incidentally, I never stopped shooting. You know, I took pictures on my travels. I took a lot of travel pictures and landscapes and sunsets. And I think they're really nice. And they're notable for having no people in them. So I think this was a very conscious move on my part. I'm done with people complaining about the way they look in photos. It's not my fault. But it's fun to be back into it at my age and taking pictures of a lot of older people. I think maybe we all look the way we look, you know, so.
Well, that brings up Van Morrison.
I was just talking about him at the gym this morning.
Cause, of course you were.
My girl came on while we were working out. Anyway, Van the man.
He's cantankerous, and apparently that was your experience as well. That's his reputation.
They wanted me to shoot the cover of the Poetic Champions Compose album. And I love Van Morrison. I've loved Van Morrison since the early 70s, I think. But, you know, not necessarily as a person, but his magical voice, his magical lyrics, stream of consciousness, one of the best albums of all time.
Astral Weeks.
Such a mysterious, magical Irish album. And it was really stream of consciousness lyrics. And what am I listening to here? That's the whole story of how I got the album, you know, from my dad. And I listened to it and I was like, what is this? And then once I listened to it a few times, I just thought it was the most amazing experience to listen to. So anyway, can you shoot the cover? But Van doesn't want to be on the cover. He wants pictures of rolling hills with a stream in the foreground. Okay, this is cutting the story short, but I drive for 3 days around the north of England, the Lake District, the Peak District, looking for rolling hills. There's no Google. I can't look it up and just look for pictures. Oh, that's where I'm going. So I got what I thought were really nice pictures, and I rented Hasselblad, you know, 2¼ square for album cover format. And word came back from Van, he didn't like the pictures. Now, the first thing I'd said at the meetings, which Van didn't attend, was, well, why don't I do it in Ireland? And I was told, no, you're not going to Ireland. Oh, well, can I get a tape of the album so I can listen to it while I'm driving? No, you can't. So when Van said he didn't like the pictures, I didn't want to use them, he said, why didn't... And again, not to me, this is through a third party, through the record company. Why didn't he go to Ireland to shoot it? So I did, you know, face palm emoji. Yeah, I wish I'd said that. And it looks like he didn't even listen to the album. Like the pictures don't match with the music. Okay. Yeah, I wish I'd asked for a tape of the album so I could have listened to it while I was shooting the pictures. And honestly, I thought the pictures were great. I was really, really pleased with them, you know, given that I'm not even back then, I didn't call myself a landscape photographer, but I thought they were nice. They were rolling hills and streams. Van wants a reshoot and the record company won't pay for it unless Van's on the cover. Van doesn't want to be on the cover. He hates having his picture taken more than nearly anyone else I've ever met. So there's a stalemate and eventually he agrees. So we do it in this pokey recording studio in Victoria. I think it's called Victoria Studios. So Van shows up and he's just so awkward. Yeah, I should show you the pictures. He's got a leather jacket on, kind of ill-fitting leather jacket. His hair is, he said he just got his hair cut specially for the shoot. And it's like, and he's standing, he sits at the piano and he's sitting like this at the piano.
Like he's never sat behind a piano before.
Yeah, it was the stiffest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I got some pictures of him holding a saxophone and then these stupid palm trees and horrible microphones in the background. And I guess I was stressed. I never moved them out of the way. So they're in the back of all these shots and they look terrible. The art director actually made a really nice album cover out of it. I credit him with finding a picture, tilting it, tinting it blue. And I'm proud of the album cover. But on the way out, I must have been waiting near the door and Van was with someone. And he walked past me and he stopped and he leaned in and he said, "Thank you. That was a lot less painful than I thought it was going to be."
That seems like the ultimate compliment.
That's exactly what I thought. Now, fast forward, I took pictures of Mr. Ivor Neville recently. You know, his family, Neville brothers, his dad and his uncles, all in the Neville brothers. And he's a great musician. He has an album coming out, a solo album coming out shortly. And we did a shoot, and he also hates having his picture taken, did not want to be on the album cover. We got on really, really well, and we got some absolutely gorgeous pictures. So hopefully one of those is going to be on the cover. But there's a picture, and he's very conscious of his age. He's not as old as me, but he's very conscious of his age. And there's this picture we did at Ben Jaffe's studio called La Casita on Dauphine Street. It's a sunroom, and I actually went outside and shot it through a screen, you know, like a window screen. It was pouring with rain. And I said, "Can you look at me?" And I just liked the way it looked. He's kind of surrounded by dark and then there's his face. And when he saw the print of it, he said, and there's a pause coming up, he said, "I look really old in that picture, but I look like I've got the souls of all the Indians." And I don't know if it's Indian culture or black masking Indian culture in New Orleans, but it's a really important part of all of the Neville brothers' background, the Meters, Galactic. And it is called Indian culture here. It's not Native American. It's actually Indian, also known as Mardi Gras Indians or Black Masking Indians. And it's something I'm really, really interested in here. So that comment, I mean, that's a nice segue because that's one of the nicest comments I've ever had about a photo. And it really meant a lot to me. And I could tell it meant a lot to him because he was quite emotional when he said it. And for him to see a picture where he thinks he looks really old, being that self-conscious about age, and then saying that really was something special.
You're in the midst of a renaissance. You got Ivan Neville and you've got Amy Schumer, both of them complimenting you. Like, these are the best photos I've ever seen. Or, you know, so it's nice.
I feel like, as I was gonna say, I know what I'm doing. I don't really know what I'm doing because the technology is still so different. I'm still like feeling my way. But in terms of my eye, and my eyes are not as good as they were either, but in terms of my photographic eye, I think it's more tuned in than it ever was. And I want to say something, if I may, and this might sound really pretentious, but about my photography. I just used to think of myself as kind of a journeyman photographer back in the 80s. Or like, I was a photographer, but I wasn't at the top of my profession. I wasn't the one who got all the high-priced album covers. When someone had a lot of money, they'd hire, you know, a French fashion photographer and pay them $20,000, or Rebecca Blake and pay £20,000 for a cover that I could have done. You know, I would have done probably for $1,000. And done a much better job, I thought. So I was kind of battling that. You know, I work for the music papers, but I don't get the big money record company shoots necessarily. And I think that informed my photography. And then looking at my photos now from back then, I think they're really good. I identify them with them very strongly now. I have a great emotional attachment to them. It's partly all the comments I've had since I had the gallery, since I've been doing Instagram lives and selling a bunch of stuff online, the comments that I get from people. I didn't know I had a style. I thought I was just a photographer. And people said, "They really love your style of photography." And that threw me for a loop because I have a style. And it turns out I do. It was, you know, even my live shots, most photographers shoot wide. And to me, that's kind of cheating. That's just too easy. I want the person. I want them up close. So my shots are all here, here, here. And if you look at the gallery as a whole, you say, "Oh, they all look like that. They've got a lot of black in them. They don't have a lot of background, a lot of instruments and Marshall amps and microphone stands and everything, if possible." And I never did those shots from behind the stage with the artists and the audience. So people identify with the pictures because it's almost like their point of view, you know, from the audience looking at the stage. And all those great pictures, if you watch the Icon documentaries on rock photography, all those iconic pictures, Freddie Mercury leaning backwards, Wembley with 80,000 people, David Bowie, Milton Keynes, Bowl from the stage with the bowl full of audience. That's not your experience if you went to that show, right? You're looking at the stage, you're looking at the artist. So to sum up, I was born in 1956, and that's the same year that Charles and Ray Eames designed the lounge chair in Ottoman, 670, 671. It's the same year that Eero Saarinen designed the Gateway to the West in St. Louis and the tulip chairs, the tulip chair and table. So, and I'm really into mid-century modernism, and I'm a mid-century boy. And Mies van der Rohe said less is more. And I realized in the last year that that somehow influenced my design sense and my photography. I always thought I was unimaginative. I didn't do big setups with elaborate props and everything. And it turns out that was my strength and not my weakness. And I kind of thought it was my weakness back then. Less is more. Very simple. It's just about the person. It's not about, you know, me interpreting them or shooting a glamorous album cover or an imaginative one. Like the Bunnymen covers, they're magnificent, Brian Griffin, but then that's just not me. That's just not what I did. That's not my vision. I don't have that vision to do what Brian Griffin did. But I still think I have my own strengths that I thought were weaknesses, but they're not. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes. That's the wisdom we gather after a lifetime, right?
Yeah.
Appreciation of yourself and your talents, your strong suits. You gather more from about the artist from what you're seeing personally.
All right. Go to work, man. What are you doing here? Come on.
This was so much fun, though. I mean, I could talk to you for hours. I didn't really answer your questions, and I didn't really tell this. Wanted to hear, but
no, that's usually when it's for the best. Whenever someone just goes off on different tangents, we love that.
Yeah, it makes more interesting and spontaneous. So, but yes, we definitely would love to for you to come back and hear some more stories.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Cheers.
Bye. Thanks, Steve. Bye.
All right. Wonderful talk with a amazing photographer, Steve Rappaport. That was really nice.
I can't get enough. If you want more stories, you can check out his website at mostlyrockandroll.com.
He's got some wonderful stories, and you could see a lot of his photos there. And where can you find photos of Holly and Dave? Where do you find us?
If you feel so inclined, at WDDIM Podcast and on our YouTube channel at What Difference Does It Make Podcast.
We have new episodes every Friday. Please like and subscribe. Do all those things. Give us a nice review if you like us or whatever you think. Reach out to us. We love to hear from you. Okay, now that our time is nigh. So until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.